Welcome to the Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte. Khalees Smith will be back tomorrow. Later in the show, we'll hear about food justice, climate justice, and social justice from the Mass Farm to School panel at Smith College with Irene Chang Lee, who co-founded Mei Mei Dumplings in Boston, Chevalier Olivier, the executive director of Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition, and East Hampton's own Ollie Peralt, a 17-year-old climate activist and farmer who's the director of Youth Climate Action Now, plus Lennox author Karen Chase on polio, FDR, creating a now legendary homosexual mythology in India, and the illegal trafficking of black bear gallbladders with her new book, History is Embarrassing. But first...
To boldly go where no man has gone before.
Not a bad way to start a Monday. By sitting down at the kitchen table of Hampshire College astronomer Dr. Salman Hamid, Mr. Universe, and talking about all things astronomical. Everybody is talking about the impending eclipse, and we're going to talk a lot about it, especially next week, about the scientific discoveries that have happened amidst eclipses of the past. But there's something exciting happening with our astronomer friend this week.
James Lowenthal. He's a fantastic speaker. He is Mary Elizabeth Moses Professor and Chair of Astronomy at Smith College. And he is giving a public talk, free, at UMass Amherst. It's called Chasing the Moon's Shadow, the Total Eclipse of April 8th, 2024. It's this Wednesday, March 27th at 7:30 p.m. in the Integrated Science Buildings Auditorium. And he has a book also about a previous an eclipse in the 1990s. He will show, I'm assuming, a lot of pictures because he has taken a lot of images of solar eclipse. I mean, it will be really cool. And he's an excellent, excellent speaker. So if you get a chance, go there this Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. in Integrated Science Buildings Auditorium at UMass Amherst, a lecture about the upcoming eclipse on April 8th.
You'll be in Dallas for the eclipse because that's in the path of totality. Khalees and I are trying to decide, should we just like pre-record a show and drive to like Vermont or Maine or someplace? But that might be ill-advised.
Well, okay, don't tell anyone, okay? So this is what you should do. You should leave early, early morning. And the reason is because you don't know which roads are going to get packed up and stuff. Look for alternative routes as well. All you have to do, I mean, eclipse, you don't need money. Okay, all you have to do is to look up. Yeah. You know, you don't need a hotel, you don't need anything. But you need to be in the path of totality. And so if you are stuck in a traffic jam, for example, but you are in the path of totality.
Just get out.
Just look up. You don't even have to get out. Just look up, right? But if you are 99%, the sun is covered 99%, it's fine. And I know, I should plug, UMass is also doing public viewing. We are not in the path of totality
but
here.
But we're at like 95%.
Yes.
But you say 95% eclipse is like a kiss versus going all the way.
Yes, that is exactly true. But you should come to UMass and Smith. I mean, I think a bunch of people are doing stuff here. But I think it's a really amazing thing. And this is the last solar eclipse for North America until 2044. And it's just a couple of minutes, but it's amazing.
Oh, it's just like going all the way.
If you know what I mean.
And James Lowenthal's lecture at UMass is this Wednesday. But we are going to talk about the moon once again.
Yeah, so we have been bringing up the issue of humans are planning on going back to the moon.
It's trash day here in Amherst. And Wookie the dog is responding to the recycling being picked up.
We have been talking about the moon. And one of the reasons is... humans are planning on going back, and it's going to set the precedence of how humans are going to be in outer space, what kind of values we will be bringing up. And this is going to happen pretty soon. Like, you know, in the next 5-6 years, we expect that NASA will have astronauts over there. There is a good chance that China will have taikonauts over there. And if you're thinking, oh, 5-6 years, wow, that's a long time. Well, pandemic was 4 years ago. So it's just right before the pandemic, if you think about it in that context. And so how do we think about these values? What are we going to say, this is our priority. This is why we are going there. And in that context, I think we as citizens, we as humans, I think all of our voices are crucial in the way we make decisions. just last week, and this is something that is yet not making front page news, but it is news. So DARPA, which stands for U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So
the DARMA initiative?
Every 108 minutes, the button must be pushed.
Oh, that's lost.
So that's DARPA, which is under the Department of Defense in the U.S. They just gave a contract to Northrop Grumman, a space company that makes actually that has a lot of defense contracts as well, basically to look for a concept, develop a concept for lunar railroad.
The concept sounds cool.
That's exactly the point. These things would sound cool, but we also have to look at, okay, so who's doing it and why?
Yeah.
So in theory, everybody says, well, this is all for peaceful purposes. And the way Northrop Grumman last week in their press release, the way they said that was the envisioned lunar railroad network could transport humans, supplies, and resources for commercial ventures across the lunar surface, contributing to a space economy for U.S. and international partners. Okay, that's okay. But you will notice that there is an element in there, and that is about space economy as well. Mm-hmm. And it's about U.S. and international partners. What I am seeing here is normally you think about the moon and you think about NASA. And yes, historically, a lot of the early explorations were defense-led. But then NASA was a civilian agency that formed in, I think, 1958 or 59 with an explicit thing like, you know, well, this is going to be a civilian venture and it's going to be open and all of those things. Now we are seeing defense taking a lead or trying to take a lead on space exploration and going to the moon. And part of this tension is coming from the creation of Space Force.
It's called the Space Force.
Space Force!
Which sounded ridiculous at the time, but it's becoming less and less ridiculous in the rhetoric of Space Force.
And that is the problem. Like, once you create the thing, I actually never thought it was ridiculous, because once you do it, once you create something, initially, however ridiculous it might be, then it seeks a purpose.
Every hammer needs a nail.
That's exactly
right. You
create
the hammer, it's going to find the nail.
Just last week, in Space News, there's an op-ed that actually says, the future of the Space Force isn't on Earth, it is in the solar system. And what it argues is that, yeah, Space Force should take lead in space exploration. And the reason is that you need to protect space commerce and U.S. and allies' commercial interests in space.
Nothing to do with science, nothing to do with the sheer human, I guess we've always had a mix of too much commerce and greed with our need for exploration, but diminishing the role of science and increasing the role of capitalism.
And that is one of the problems, because, I mean, you can imagine that the moon can be a place for scientific research. There is phenomenal science to be done over there. You have the far side of the moon that is perfect for radio telescopes. In fact, there are people who have already designs for it. And for decades, like, you know, that this would be an amazing place. You just think about the discovery of water ice on the moon in the craters that has gathered for hundreds of millions and billions of years. And if you look at some of the documents that come out from space exploration, including NASA's, they say, well, that would be great for, of course, for drinking, but also to use as a fuel. And I can imagine some of the planetary astronomers and geologists sort of like, you know, squirming, because just think about the information those kind of water samples actually contain, mm-hmm. collected over hundreds of millions and billions of years, because they are in the shadowed regions of the craters in the north and south pole of the moon. And of course, the moon also provides you with an amazing history of the solar system. You can imagine, if we put our values, and by we, I mean we all as humans on Earth, we say, look, the moon is an amazing place for doing scientific research. Let's create a research base like the Antarctica, for example, and build international cooperation. There are some people that have argued that this is a perfect next step from the collaborative International Space Station, which is a great example that even with the Ukraine war going on, Russia and the U.S. are still actually cooperating on the International Space Station. And so the moon can be, it's one of those things that we decide what humans' future is going to be. We decide how humans are, whether we look for the better side or the worst side. And so if we say, like, well, Moon is a great place for international collaboration for science, then that's what it becomes. What I'm concerned about is that the rhetoric that is coming in, and there is more funding, for example, from the defense side, because you can have a $1 trillion budget as well, that balance is changing as soon as the moon is becoming more accessible.
There have been some disturbing quotes from some of the folks who are at the helm of Space Force for what their designs are when we go back to the moon. And again, diminishing sort of NASA's role as a civilian scientific endeavor and increasing Space Force's role as a militaristic and capitalistic endeavor.
Right. I mean, so first of all, I mean, China is again being used as a foil. And we don't know what China is thinking. So yeah, that is always there. But to use that to say, because they might do that, we should do the worst thing first. Well, that is exactly the problem in there. And that's how people justify it. So I should mention that there is a memorandum of understanding between NASA and Space Force already, which actually says that the military branch, this is the Space Force, sphere of influence will extend to 272,000 miles and beyond, at least to the far side of the moon. A more than tenfold increase in range and 1,000-fold expansion in service volume. This is in the memorandum of understanding saying that Space Force is going to have the sphere influence.
Let me just stop you right there. Yeah. That means that Space Force is in control of everything between here and the far side of the moon?
Well, they want, which is called, they call it the cislunar space between here and the moon. I mean, that is the idea that they want to control the space in between. Now, I should mention, militaries and other world militaries as well, not just the US, in the low Earth orbit, they play a dominant role because they think that satellites, for example, are crucial to communications, are crucial for troop movements on Earth. But now that range, so from lower Earth orbit, this is where this comes in. This is around 22,000 miles, or even less than 22,000 miles, but that's the where the geostationary satellites come in, all the way extending tenfold more to the moon. They think that entire space should be under the auspices or under
jurisdiction
of Space Force. That is one of the ideas in there, not NASA. This is not something that is coming from some conspiracy sites and things like that. So this was in the memorandum of understanding. And then the number two person, the deputy commander of U.S. Space Command, he actually recently retired. He's from Massachusetts, General John Shaw. He's a huge proponent of Space Force, really taking control of space exploration. And he says, NASA is a research and technology organization. It has little incentive to develop, open, and protect new areas for commercial exploitation. And in fact, he explicitly used the example of high seas and the 19th century. And he says, and this is a quote from him, that the primary purpose of peacetime military forces was to explore, map, and protect exploitation of the unknown portions of the North American continent. And he says, this is what is needed. Space Force should be leading the thing, and again, once again, protecting the commercial interest, the commercial exploitation of resources for American interests.
And they even said exploitation, which is interesting use of words there. If you're going to try to convince people, I would choose different words, perhaps.
And for 19th century. Yeah. I mean, Monty, we've talked about the American Buffalo.
Ken Burns' documentary on PBS. I finally watched the first half of it.
Which is amazing. People should go and watch it because, again, if you are going for commercial benefits, this is the case. I mean, he explicitly used the example of the unknown portions of the American continent, which were not unknown to the people who actually lived there.
Yeah.
They were very known because they were there. But the logic from that, the way the buffalo got extinct, and this is just one example, that is very different from a lot of people, the way they think about space exploration. When they think about space exploration, they think about, oh, for example, the Star Trek, oh, we are doing exploration for the sake of exploration. Oh, we are exploring new worlds, right? But that is not what Space Force is doing or saying. And it looks like, and again, as I mentioned, this recent op-ed piece from last week as well, there are arguments that are being made that, well, if we don't do it, China will do it, and hence we should do it, meaning to say that our defense should lead the exploration part. And it's not exploration. The primary purpose of that is for commercial exploitation. What do we think the result would be if our values, the way we are bringing it to the moon, are centered on profits? I mean, the history on this planet, wherever it has happened, from British East India Company to exploitation here in North America and to everywhere else, there was just this Sunday, there was this heartbreaking story of especially women being exploited in India for in sugarcane fields for Coke and Pepsi. I mean, their lives are ruined. They are in slave-like situations for creating sugar water. But that's the logic that's behind it. So if we think in some world that, oh, by the way, once we go to the moon with the principles of commercial exploitation, we are going to do better. Well, I have a bridge to sell you somewhere.
NASA is to Star Trek as Space Force is to the Galactic Empire in Star Wars?
I didn't say that, but sure. No, but I mean, Gene Roddenberry, creator of Star Trek, he wanted to have a positive humanistic view of the universe. He was very explicit about it, and he was making the show in the 1960s, and at that time, at the height of the Cold War, he had a Russian on the deck of the starship.
It was Martin Luther King Jr.'s favorite TV show.
Because of Uhura, an African-American character in there. He had an Asian character in there. He was very explicit about the future can be bright if we get the right values. And I think it goes back to this issue, what values we bring to the moon.
George Lucas just made a lot of toys.
I'm not going to say anything about that. But here is one other thing I would say, that we have the capability, we have the ability to raise our voices and argue for a scientific exploration. Have the science take the lead. Do not fall under, as you also said, hey, railroad on the moon, sounds cool. Yeah, but underneath it, there may be a lot of things that are not cool. And so keep your eyes open. When the AI issue came up, it was too late. People are suddenly like, oh my goodness, the AI is here. We haven't thought about it. Here we have a few years. Be engaged. Look for the second line beyond the very sexy headline that comes up. Look underneath. If you hear commercial exploitation, defense, just run.
To raise your voice.
Next week, Mr. Universe and I will talk more about the April 8th eclipse, and a reminder that Smith astronomer James Lowenthal hosting a talk about the eclipse this Wednesday evening, 7:30 at UMass in the Integrated Sciences Building. Later in the show, Karen Chase on her new book, History is Embarrassing. But up next, we'll hear about food justice, climate justice, and social justice from the Mass Farm to School panel that I was lucky enough to moderate at Smith College. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by Northeast Solar, homegrown in Hatfield, Massachusetts, and providing energy savings for their customers for over 10 years. Learn more at northeast-solar.com.
Welcome back to The Fabulous 413. You might have heard Friday on the show Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll and the Massachusetts Farm to Sea Food Conference that happened at Smith College. After the Lieutenant Governor spoke, I was honored to moderate a panel of food justice advocates, including Irene Chang Lee, who co-founded May May Dumplings in Boston, Chevalier Olivier, the executive director of Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition, and East Hampton's own Ollie Peralt, a 17-year-old climate activist and farmer who's the director of Youth Climate Action Now. Here is some of that conversation.
Let's start with you, Irene. The theme of this conference is rooted in resilience, centering climate and community. Talk about how your dumpling business interacts with food justice.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for having me. I'm here today because I believe that restaurants can and should be about so much more than just our paying customers. We serve such an important role in our communities, and I think that there's more we can do. May May started out as a food truck and then quickly became a full-service restaurant, and we now have a 5,000-square-foot dumpling factory, cafe, and classroom in South Boston. We opened with a real commitment to working with local producers and using meat from animals raised on pasture. I was 21 years old and very passionate and opinionated about that. And since then, we've expanded our focus to think more broadly about the food system, about how to create amazing jobs in food service, and of course, you know, dumplings are a really good conversation starter. And so we are able to host people in our space, to feed them dumplings, and to have sometimes challenging conversations, but doing it all over food helps a lot. We also have been really proud to serve our food in some public schools in the Boston metro area. And apparently the young folks in the Cambridge public schools love mushroom tofu dumplings, which I definitely never thought was gonna be a thing. So we have been able to kind of, again, expand the way we think about what a restaurant can do, not just through the food we buy, but also how we sell it and who we sell it to. And I'm also very proud to be on the boards of Project Bread, the Haley House, and the Food Project, and that has allowed me to continue to think about this question. Like, how does the food industry actually intersect with food justice and move all of that agenda forward?
Before you started your own business, were you in the food industry before that? Did you experience it from the other side where you can see the inequities that are built in there? You can see the cost-cutting measures that may go into it to try to, because the margins on owning restaurants are not great. So it's understandable why, you know, sometimes people make these decisions. You really have to go above and beyond if you want to be ethical in the way you're gonna source and the way you're gonna treat your employees. Did you experience it from the other side and then have an aha moment where you say, I'm gonna try to change this?
I have always been a very passionate eater from a Chinese American family, and it's always about what are we eating right now, what are we eating tomorrow? And I think that what I was really curious about was why restaurants couldn't do better. And I learned real quick that having your values and practicing your values is a matter of what you can afford.
Right.
If you can't afford to pay a living wage, you don't have a business. If you can't afford to use compostables, how do you create more? And so for me, this work is really about having an abundance mindset. How do we create more for everyone instead of hoard the little that we have? And that's what a lot of my work in consulting is now, is trying to figure out how we get businesses to the point where they can afford the things that they really care about. Like, nobody opens a restaurant and says, I would love to use styrofoam and exploit people. That is not why people get into food. But that is what happens because we act like this is a zero-sum game.
Chevelle, you work in Mattapan. You're from Mattapan. You live there your whole life. Tell us how food interacts with the kind of social justice and activism work and resiliency that you're doing in Mattapan with the organizations that you lead.
Yes, so Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition, so we do a mix of a lot of things because a lot of things that we do intersect with your life. So the first thing that we did do when we organized our organization was a farmer's market. But you also have to realize that your health comes in a package, and you also have to think not only about nutrition and food, you also have to think about the physical activity component of that as well. Just being with Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition, learning about all of the intersections of living a healthy lifestyle was very valuable to me. We do food access, nutrition education, physical activity, so some walking challenges, biking is my thing, is what I'm into. We also have a youth group. And then we also focus on the built environment, because the built environment is also important to live in a healthy lifestyle, and food justice and food access is also important in that. And then lastly, just making sure that the community is deeply involved in making sure that they can advocate for what it is that they want to see in their community.
Is it true that you started that farmer's market, or you were at the beginning of the...
No, I did not start the farmer's market. Okay. So I started at the organization when I was 17, so 3 years after it was founded. And so the farmer's market was the first thing that was organized. But what I was able to do was expand our physical activity, more specifically our transportation advocacy work.
I know here in Western Massachusetts, transportation is a major issue too, and our legislative delegation has been trying to work on that. In places like Springfield, there may be a food desert where you're not close enough in walking distance to bring groceries home. You need to take public transportation. The public transportation out here limits how many bags of groceries you as an individual are allowed to bring with you on a bus. So if you're trying to feed a family of five, you're only allowed to bring two grocery bags on the bus, and you can't walk from that place to where you live, there's a problem inherent there. What's it like in the, you know, we hear, we pay for a lot of public transportation with the MBTA as taxpayers in Western Mass. Tell us about some of the issues transportation-wise that the people you're working with are dealing with when it comes to food access.
Yeah, so a word that I like to use in regards to the Mattapan community is that there are food opportunities or choices in the Mattapan community. And so we don't necessarily have a food desert. What we have is food apartheid because of choices of food that we have are not the best. There's a lot of corner stores. Majority of our community is 87% Black, and that includes African American and those who live in urban cultures. And so we have a lot of those food. So it's a food apartheid for us and not necessarily a food desert. And so there's lots of corner stores that are in walking distance. Like, I can walk to Mattapan Square, and there's like five corner stores literally in walking distance, in like a 2.8 square mile distance. But like you mentioned, in order to get to a grocery store, I would probably have to hop on the bus. But in order to get to a really good grocery store, I would probably have to take the commuter rail or train. And that definitely takes a lot of time. I feel like that there has been some efforts made in terms of transportation to get people closer to the amenities that will work well for their health. But I just feel like there needs to be a lot of work done in the actual communities to build up those amenities that that the community can actually walk to and get to without having to think about jumping on a bus or how much they can take home because they, you know, they don't have the privilege of being able to own a car.
We heard Lieutenant Governor reference urban farming in Salem. I know there's a great organization in Springfield called Gardening the Community that kind of popped up to try to meet the needs of that community in Mason Square, Springfield, that is experiencing many of the same things that you were just talking about in Mattapan. Is urban farming something that's been going on that you've seen at all in Mattapan or even backyard gardening in any way?
Yes, yes, yes. And the wonderful thing about being with the organization for Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition for a very long time is that I can see the growth of individuals, of things in the landscape of the community, but also I have a lot of mentors. So Miss Pat, her name is Patricia Spence, but I call her Miss Pat out of respect. She had an idea. And I'm pretty sure there was a lot of other people that were involved in that as well, but I'm more close with Miss Pat. And I remember, you know, back in 2015, I worked closely with her son, was saying that he was going to like clear out some greenery somewhere because they were gonna revitalize a farm. Now the farm is here and now they actually own the space as of this year, which is really great. But that was the first time that I was exposed to urban farming and I didn't know what urban farming was. So now I have a place in my community where I can walk to, it's about 20 minutes from my house or 15, depending on how fast or slow I'm walking. And I can just go into that space and I can just talk to the staff. And I can just, if I want to, you know, be in the soil, I can, I try not to. I don't like to get dirty, which is really ironic considering the organization that I work for, but you know, if I wanted to go there, I could. And not only that, like I can also invite my littles, like my nieces and nephews, I call them my littles. Like now that I can go and take them so they can experience that from a young age and not have to learn about those types of things as they get older.
Coming up, more from the Massachusetts Farm and Sea to Food Conference that I moderated at Smith College. We'll hear from East Hampton's own Ollie Peralt, a 17-year-old climate activist and farmer who's the director of Youth Climate Action Now. How is her family farm, Mountain View in East Hampton, gearing up for the uncertainty that is our current climate? We'll find out next. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM. Welcome back to The Fabulous 413. Coming up, poet and author Karen Chase on polio, FDR, creating a now legendary homosexual mythology in India, and black bear gallbladders with her new book, History is Embarrassing, which she'll be reading from at Amherst Books this Friday. Right now, more from the Massachusetts Farm and Sea to Food Conference that happened at Smith College last week. 17-year-old climate activist and lifelong farmer Ollie Peralt from Mountain View Farm in East Hampton.
Speaking of learning about farming from a very young age, I grew up in the Boston area, in the suburbs of Boston, and the only farm I ever went to was Cumberland Farms. My farm to school was like Chicken Nugget Day was the highlight of it. Things have changed, luckily, in a lot. Again, thanks to our legislative delegation, many of whom I was at the White House Conference on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health with, talking about why we need to do better in getting farm fresh food into the bodies of our children through our public school system. You, Ollie, grew up on a farm. It's one of the largest farms in Western Mass, one of the largest CSAs in Western Mass. When you hear the different experiences of us on stage, of the other panelists, Compare that to growing up on a farm and what you experienced.
So my family runs Mountain View Farm. We're based in East Hampton, but we're all over Western Mass. From a very young age, I've been experiencing the different extremes of the climate crisis very firsthand. I think I have an interesting perspective getting involved in the climate conversation because I was in this weird position of trying to find where my voice fits into the movement while simultaneously being directly impacted and having conversations with my family about how we're going to continue adapting to these extremes. So when I was about 11, I got involved with Mass Audubon's Youth Climate Leadership Program, which is a statewide initiative that works to empower students from all across Massachusetts to get involved in our annual climate summits, which are just an opportunity for young people to connect in a youth-led space with really wonderful adult mentors and learn about youth empowerment, environmental justice. So yeah, I think I've had an interesting perspective of being in this position of trying to empower and lift up my peers and seeing firsthand the extremes of climate change.
We mentioned that last year was a particularly difficult year, not just for your farm, but farms across the valley. I have the opportunity to talk to farmers who've been doing it for generations and are connected to generations before that. And one of them being March and Mass Maple Month, here in Massachusetts, it's interesting to talk to a farmer to see how they used to tap late March, because that's when the sap runs were happening. Now they're tapping around Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. Things have changed dramatically, even in the course of their own lifetimes. Have you, you're very young still, is there things that you have changed dramatically even in the short amount of time you've been on the planet?
Absolutely. So I think when I am talking to people and trying to put into context the extremes that local farmers are trying to adapt to, I usually have given the example of the droughts in 2020, 2021, or the extreme rainfall in 2022. But now we have this much starker example of how local family-run farms are trying to adapt to these increasing extremes, which was the flooding last summer. So my family's farm had over 45 acres submerged under the Connecticut River. That's over half of our distribution. So I think it's, yes, we're definitely seeing more and more extremes. And we're sort of faced with the question of how do we adapt to a crisis of this scale? Because currently, the solutions that are being presented to us aren't meeting the scale of the crisis that we are experiencing. So I think this summer we really took some time, I took some time to assess what it means to be a young person in the climate conversation and try to make a direct impact while simultaneously having to try to adapt to these changes with my family. So I think that it really gave us some time to reassess why we're involved in the climate conversation in the first place and reconnect to why we're fighting this fight. We sort of stumbled across this idea of transformative change, which is about redefining what direct action means and sort of realizing that we can't continue working through these preconceived systems of power to make a difference. We have to get creative and we have to start doing things differently. For me, that's about trying to figure out how young people fit into the climate solution, which I believe that centering these voices is sort of the solution to the climate crisis, because we have this very unique perspective as the people who are going to inherit these systems.
Can you give us an example, something creative and out of the box that you feel particularly proud of that your organization's done?
Yeah, so right now, I think the most exciting thing that we're working on is this project, a couple different projects around interdisciplinary climate justice education. We have a bill, I believe it's House 496, that's called the Interdisciplinary Climate Justice Education Bill, which is basically realizing that young people need something more hopeful, we need something more humanities focused, and we need something more action oriented. We need connections to other outside organizations who know how to mentor and empower young people to sort of take the lead and recognize that we don't have to wait until we're adults to make a difference. And then we are also working with the Massachusetts Climate Resilient Schools Coalition, which is this network that connects students, faculty, administration, and infrastructure to sort of think about how we can reform our climate curriculums while simultaneously making our school buildings more sustainable and climate friendly. So we have a couple different initiatives around that. Another really exciting thing that we're doing is
We're working in Mass Audubon's Youth and Leadership Program. We're doing a lot of work to center mental health conversations and make sure that young people have the support to handle feelings of eco anxiety, feelings of eco grief, and sort of making these youth-led spaces where young people have the opportunity to connect in youth-led spaces and build each other up, but then to connect to mental health experts so that we can avoid feelings of activist burnout, feelings of eco anxiety, feelings of like grappling with the unpredictability of our futures.
Speaking of eco anxiety and the fatigue that comes along with working towards justice, it is also an election year, so that may bring a whole other level of anxiety to certain people. But let's try to end on a positive note. Irene, what's something that you and your organizations have done that is giving you a particular amount of hope going forward that you think may inspire other people to not give up hope?
One of the things that's giving me a lot of hope is seeing how much consumers and restaurant diners really want to hear our stories from working in the food industry. I think, you know, in prior generations, going to a restaurant, the food just appeared in front of you and the kitchen was kind of behind this curtain. And we have at Maymay an open kitchen and a huge window that looks onto our production floor. And every time I see a guest, be they any age or height, you know, peering through the window, I'm like, that's awesome. Because we're able to have a conversation and to interact and connect with each other over food. Last year, we did a campaign for AAPI Heritage Month called Dumpling Disloyalty. We asked all of our guests to go to 8 different Asian or Asian American owned businesses and eat some kind of dumpling. It could be a samosa or a gyoza or a momo or whatever. And then they could come back to Maymay and their next order of dumplings would be on us. And over the month of May, we had more than 100 people participate. And they said, like, we went to places we've never been before. We met new restaurant owners in our neighborhoods. We explored. We were just so thrilled by that the invitation to connect more deeply resonated with people. And so we're going to be running that challenge again in May. And I think that's what gives me the hope. Our diners and our community members really do want to engage with what's happening in our businesses.
I'm going to come in my Kung Fu dumpling t-shirt there. We have a weird dumpling connection that we don't have time to get into right now. It's very weird, but I'll tell you after you stop me. Chevelle, what's something that your organization is doing to make you feel hopeful that you feel like might inspire somebody else?
Yes. So one thing that I'm really that's making me feel really hopeful is that I feel like that our organization is really changing the way in which municipalities interact with the community.
Supposed to be hopeful. I'm sorry. I feel like I deal with a different set of challenges in my community when it comes to food justice. So I would be remiss if I didn't say it.
Oh yeah.
I think that municipalities are changing the way in which they interact with the communities, and hopefully they will be able to, it just becomes something that they just do naturally and not something for other reasons.
You already talked a little bit about what you were hopeful about. You got one more quick thing that you're hopeful about, Holly?
I have two really quick things. Over the summer, my family was grappling with this flooding disaster, we were really supported by our community. We're a small CSA, so that community support was so wonderful. Someone like left a bundle of poems tied with tomato pine on our steps, and everyone was just like pouring in all this support for our family. And so that was incredible, and just seeing how our community can rally together and make it possible to start over again next year so we can continue providing healthy, organic, local produce to our community. And then also, I'm really inspired and empowered by the young people that I get to work with, and I'm so excited to see so many students here today. And it makes me so happy that there's so many young people here. And so I encourage you all as adults, as teachers, just reach out to the students here today, and hopefully you'll be inspired together.
Anybody got any questions for any of our panelists? I'll do this Phil Donahue style, which will also totally date me as a human being. But I will run to the audience, and anybody got a question, raise your hand, and I'll run up to you.
How did Phil Donahue do this? What, did he have to go in front and put his butt in front of everybody's face?
Hi, Holly. What are you planning to do to manage the water?
To manage water?
On the farm.
To manage the water?
When it comes to adoption, we're sort of having to face this challenge of not knowing which way the pendulum will sway with the unpredictability. So it's either going to be like really, really dry and we're going to have no water, or it's going to be a disaster flood and our crops are all going to be underwater. So for the too much water, we have some cultural practices that we're changing, like higher beds and planting really intentionally so that if there is a flood, being intentional about timing. And then also with too much water, we have some irrigation strategies that we're implementing. We have an irrigation gun that's sort of new. We really don't know which way the pendulum will swing, and it's sort of trying to figure out how we can balance both.
Let's give a round of applause for us.
That was live from the Mass Farm and Sea to School Conference at Smith College last Friday. East Hampton's own Ollie Peralt, a 17-year-old climate activist and farmer who's the director of Youth Climate Action Now. Chevalier Olivier, the executive director of Mattapan Food and Fitness Coalition. And Irene Shang Lee, who co-founded Mei Mei Dumplings in Boston. This is a weird story, but I have a T-shirt from Kung Fu Dumplings in Provincetown. And on the back of it, it says, "I hate dumplings." Just kidding. Can you imagine? Somebody took a picture of me in this T-shirt when I was at Preservation Hall in New Orleans, and it has now become a meme across the country. When I talked to the owner of Mei Mei Dumplings, Irene, I said, "It's so funny, I have this shirt." And she pulled out her phone and showed me a picture of me on her phone, because anytime this picture makes the rounds on the internet, somebody sends it to her. Ah, what a small world. Coming up, poet and author Karen Chase on her new book, History is Embarrassing. She'll be at Amherst Books this Friday, and she'll join us next. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM. Welcome back to The Fabulous 413. Karen Chase is a Western Mass writer and painter. Her poems, stories, and essays have appeared in many magazines, including The New Yorker, The New Republic, and Southwest Review. She's the author of two collections of poems, Casimir Square and Bear, as well as Jamali Kamali, a book-length homoerotic poem which takes place in India. Her book Land of Stone tells the story of her work with a silent young man in a psychiatric hospital where she was the hospital poet. Many of these stories appear in the new collection of essays, History is Embarrassing. She'll be reading from this book this Friday evening at 7 at Amherst Books in conversation with Jennifer Rosner. Welcome, Karen Chase.
So nice to be here.
Turns out my son knows your granddaughter. We just found this out in the green room. They're good friends. So it continues to be a small world. Can you read a little bit from your book, History is Embarrassing?
Of course. History is embarrassing. It's embarrassing to be part of history. My life is small. History is big. Best to stay small. You can hold the matchbooks of history in your hand. My life is small, your life is small, my town is small, and always was. If you don't make the connections, you can stay small. But all in all, history is big. And so are you, and so am I, because we're people and we're alive. It's embarrassing to write about yourself because of what my mother said. Best to be a lady, private, dignified. For Roosevelt, anything less than history was embarrassing. History was him, and he would make it, and what a job he would do. He was a patrician, and I'm from peasant Ashkenazi stock. He was a man, and I was a girl.
This book, History is Embarrassing, talks a lot about your contracting polio and looking up to FDR as sort of an idol. I know that they tried at the time to try to keep FDR's disability on the down low. Were you aware at the time when you were a child that he was struggling with polio?
No, because I was so little.
Uh-huh.
I was barely born.
Now, when did that come to your attention and why was that so inspirational to you?
My parents worked for the Roosevelt campaigns to get him elected. So when I was growing up, I was always aware of FDR, and I knew he had had polio. So when I contracted polio when I was a little girl, of course, it meant a lot to me that the connection to him. In fact, I kind of felt he was my grandfather.
Well, it's interesting because then you go on to be the visiting writer in residence at the FDR homestead later in life.
Right, right. Yes, no, I've always felt very connected to him.
We're speaking with Karen Chase, whose new book is History is Embarrassing. I must say that there's not a ton that's embarrassing personally about this. I can think of, and have probably said on the radio, many, many more embarrassing things. There's some really exciting stories in this collection of essays, including how you, on a visit to India, found a story that you turned into some piece of fiction that now, if you go to tourist websites about this place in India, your fiction has become what appears to be fact. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I went to India in 2004 on a writing residency. And while I was there, I was taken to a newly opened, renovated site called the Jamali Kamali Mosque and Tomb. And we were told, the people who were being toured around were told that they, Jamali and Kamali, had been homosexual lovers, but they didn't have it on a sign outside.
Right.
So I went back to my desk and I just started writing as if I was Jamali speaking to Kamali. And I wrote for a year and a half, and it ended up being a love story between these two men. And then just a couple of years ago, I went online. The book came out in India in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And I went online to check how the book was faring and found that my poem, which was a complete fiction, was being quoted as the historical record and as if the lines I had written had been written by Jamali in 1585.
Uh-huh. You've tried to get them to correct the record to say this is fiction, however, right?
Right. And they did correct it, but then I got really curious and I kept going online and kept finding other examples. Now, of course, not everybody thinks that's the real story, but enough people do. Anyway, history's embarrassing. I mean, the way history is formed is so fascinating
yeah.
to me. It's messy. It's messy.
History is Embarrassing is the name of this collection of essays from Lennox author Karen Chase. She'll be at Amherst Books this Friday evening at 7 o'clock. The story I thought was the most fascinating and very brave of you to go tell, that I want to see fleshed out into a full-length book, is about Operation Berkshire and the illegal hunting and harvesting and trafficking of black bear gallbladders. How did this story come across your transom?
I was on jury duty, and I was in the room with all the other people waiting to see if we were called, and somebody started saying, "I saw a bear last night," and then everybody had a bear story,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody mentioned that there had been this rogue group of hunters in the Berkshires and in New England killing bears. And
but you're traveling into the woods with hunters and, you know.
No. I didn't travel into the woods with them.
Okay.
They told me about
okay.
it.
Okay. But you went to go visit some people that could have been potentially nefarious people to get this
That's
story.
That's true. That is very true. I was very brave and careful.
It is interesting. What, for those who don't know, what is the gallbladder, black bear gallbladder, used for? Why were people so interested in it?
For medicinal purposes and aphrodisiacs.
And you're even going to Chinatown trying to illegally buy this stuff to see if the traffic has made it there. The book is a collection of essays, and as I said, it's really fascinating. There's beautiful essays about a road trip that you take with your son. There's a fascinating essay about you going to Smith & Wesson in Springfield and learning how to shoot. These are really amazing essays, and you'll be in conversation about them at Amherst Books this Friday at 7 o'clock.
Yes, with Jennifer Rosner, the rock star novelist.
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming in today. Lennox author Karen Chase, the book is History is Embarrassing. And say hello to your granddaughter, who I guess, you know, as embarrassing and small world it is, I happen to know.
Thanks for having me.
If you, as I know you are a public radio listener, you've heard of Car Talk. Tomorrow, EV Car Talk. Last week, the Biden administration announced some new electric vehicle goals. And Tuesday on the Fabulous 413, UMass Amherst Professor Aaron Baker and Dwayne Breger will let us know how the electric vehicle landscape is poised to change. We'll also talk with Naomi Simonic from Deer Creek Farm in Granby. Contrary to the name, they're raising cows and sheep, not deer. Khalees is back tomorrow and hopefully will tell us everything about experiencing Andre 3000's flute album live. I'm Monty Belmonte. We'll see you tomorrow on the Fabulous 413.
Tuning boy, feel the pain, feel the joy. Sidestep the little bits of history repeating.